Hey there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fans in Motion, the Ultimate Night Ranger podcast. This episode is part two of the interview with Michael Cardelloni, drummer for Damn Yankees and drummer for Lynyrd Skynyrd. So if you're finding this episode, you got to go back and you got to watch episode one. Fantastic episode. Get you all his early life in Cleveland and getting to New York City and getting the gig with Damn Yankees, and this episode will obviously focus on that early Damn Yankees record. So sit back and enjoy part two with our interview of with Michael Cardelloni.
And said, the Damn Yankees project is going to get another shot. I just got off the phone with Jack Blades. He's going to come in and round out the band. And he did. And that made all the difference. Jack coming in was the perfect balance between Tommy and Ted, stylistically. You know him. Ball of energy, incredibly talented, great songwriter. And we kind of repeated history. We went right back to the Tommy Shaw Band room in Columbus Circle. We spent a couple days, came up with coming of age, high enough, tell me how you want it. Klogner flew in, loved what he heard in the room, said, I want to see you guys do this in front of a crowd. So, and this ties in nicely, we went to the China Club. Unannounced, after the house band was done playing and took a break, we just went up on stage. And it was just one of those wonderful China Club moments that I had described before. Hey, Jeff Beck is up there. Hey, Ted Nugent, Tommy Shaw, Jack Blades, and some Italian-looking kid is up there. And the place went crazy. And we played a very early version of Coming of Age. I don't think the words were even done yet. Tommy was just scatting. And Klogner loved what he heard. Paid for another demo. Geffen passed again. That one was shocking because that demo had High Enough and Coming of Age and Come Again on it. But before long, Warner Brothers shined their smile upon us, and that record ended up selling 2 million albums.
So was there ever, one that's got, that China Club show was that was the first time you had played live with those three
Correct.
together. Obviously the Tommy and Ted before.
If I
When,
can interrupt,
yeah.
another fun thing happened. Cheap Trick had just played in New York that night, and Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander popped into the China Club because that's what you did back then. After Damn Yankees did its little impromptu set, Robin and Rick came up on stage and we did the song Cold Turkey by John Lennon. And I've got photos of all of us on stage.
There you
Yeah. So not only is it the first ever appearance by Damn Yankees, but then we get photobombed by the Cheap Trick guys.
Well, that's a pretty good first gig. And
Also,
I try to think of myself in your shoes. I would just be like, what the fuck am I doing here? How'd this happen?
it was a surreal experience.
Did you ever, a couple of things. One, do you, I guess, I always picture it differently, maybe not as a musician, more on the fan side. But when Tommy and Jack would bring in High Enough or Coming of Age, and you hear it for the first time, is it always just, oh, that's another song that's great? Or is there ever a moment when you're just like, what the fuck is this?
Yes, and that moment happened when they played High Enough. It was undeniable. When we heard them working on High Enough, we knew they struck gold.
And then you obviously you got Tommy Shaw from Styx, Ted Nugent, Jack Blades from Night Ranger. Did you ever worry, did it ever cross your mind that maybe they would bring in, I'm trying to think of an unemployed.
A fourth all-star. Of course it did. Of course it did. It wasn't until two weeks before we recorded the album, the first album in LA. 2 weeks before they finally said, "Oh, by the way, you're officially in the band." Because it was never discussed. This band built over the course of 10 months, and I was the only one who was drumming. Anytime we were working, it was me, but it was never discussed. But I kept thinking, at some point, am I still going to be? And because it was never discussed, it was always in the back of my mind. When is the shoe going to drop? And I will tell you, we were at Jack's house, summertime, I guess, 1990. We wrote Pile Driver in Jack's basement. I remember that. Anyway, so it was in the summer of 1990 at Jack's house in Northern California. And I remember it was starting to leak out. We hadn't signed the deal yet, but it was starting to leak out that this supergroup of these three famous guys is being formed. And phone calls started to come in. I absolutely remember Joey Kramer from Aerosmith, great drummer, calling and talking to Jack saying, "Man, I would love to play on your record." So things like that started to happen. And none of this was being hidden from me, which was kind of cool, but also very unsettling at the same time. And then one day, it was Tommy, God bless him, Tommy Shaw. Tommy was the one that said, "Oh, by the way, you're officially the drummer in the band." "Oh, cool, man. Thanks, thanks."
Now,
I'm like, I haven't been bothered about that
do
at
you
all.
think they just being in their own world, how musicians can be, do you think they naturally assumed you knew?
Maybe.
And then just maybe one day realized, did we ever tell him?
It was literally, and I mentioned it before, it was 2 weeks before we recorded the record. And it was just kind of a matter of fact. I think I already had a plane flight to go to LA to record, and I still didn't know. We were sitting around Jack's basement one day with Ron Nevison, who produced both Damn Yankee Records. And I think just in conversation, it might have come up about, so and so drummer called and said he wants to play on this record. And I remember Nevison saying, like, "Well, why? He could be like, well, he's right here. He's already in it." It was just very kind of unspoken, organic. for everybody else except for me, who was waiting. Is somebody going to say something?
So, I mean, you had done, the recording, the studio work with, Eddie. Was this, besides that, like the big, is this like one of your biggest studios you'd been in?
No question about it. This was absolutely the biggest thing up to that point that I was about to do. And everything about it was next level. It's now Warner Brothers, and we're now recording in Los Angeles at A&M Studios, which is on the Charlie Chaplin lot, which is like Mecca for me, because I'm a lifelong Chaplin fanatic. Ron Nevison is producing, who had engineered Physical Graffiti and Quadrophenia. This was a whole new ball game for me. But even as a, how old would I have been? 28, I guess, 27. Even then, because there had been this 10-month buildup from just jamming in the Tommy Shaw rehearsal room to now recording the record for Warner Brothers. In that 10-month buildup, it was a very smooth, natural progression. So every step of it was exciting, but at no point was it overwhelming because it just gradually built like this. And by the time we got to the studio to record the album, I was in such a zone that I did the tracks in less than half of the time that Nevison had booked. He could not believe how quickly I got the drum tracks, and I think it's just because I was so in the zone. And Tommy, Jack, and Ted had molded me to what I needed to be for the drumming. And because I had been there since day one, what I was doing was completely intertwined musically with the other three. So if you listen to Coming of Age, which is probably my favorite Damn Yankee song, the drum part on that is very unusual. It gets very syncopated, and I attribute that absolutely to those years working with Eddie Jobson. So even though the drum part of Coming of Age has this wonderful straight ahead Stones, Charlie Watts quality, when you start to decipher it, there's some weird stuff going on. And I remember Carmine Appice, great drummer, was writing a drum column for a magazine at one point, and he charted out Coming of Age. He said, "What this guy did here is very bizarre and very unusual, but it works." So I'm saying this because over those 10 months, the way I was playing had become part of the sound of this band. So had Joey Kramer come in at the very last minute and recorded with them, he would have done a wonderful job, I'm sure, but it would not have sounded the way it sounded to Tommy, Jack, and Ted, because my drumming informed the way those songs sounded. And it would have been very strange, I think, for Tommy, Jack, and Ted, all of a sudden, at the very last minute, to have someone else there because of what I had done for those 10 months became part of the sound.
Well, and Ted, I'm not, like I said, a musician, so I'm maybe not wording it right, but Ted plays with such feel, and it seems like Tommy plays with feel and emotion, to where if Joey Kramer came in at the last moment, he could play tracks, but I feel like he wouldn't have that feel. of those two guys, where you said 10 months being there, you it's organic almost.
Right. And to at the last minute, and this is for any musician, at the last minute to come in and just play a track, I'm sure, you can get great results. The difference is if what was there prior had developed over such a long period of time that it became woven into the fabric of the material. And by the time we recorded that first album, my drumming was woven into the fabric of the material and informed the way it was recorded and the way Tommy, Jack, and Ted played off of me and the way I was playing off of them, because we had all that time to develop it. It was the ultimate garage band, Damn Yankees. We were rehearsing in each other's basements and Ted's, farm in Detroit, and Jack's basement in Northern California. So, all of that time, that groundwork, blood, sweat, and tears, you can't replace at the very last second with a session ace. It's just not going to be the same because you won't have had the building over the time that the four of us did.
I think one thing you mentioned, and it's, I think you're very unique, your situation is where most of the time people getting their big break, and you could say, Eddie Jobson was a break and Tommy was a break. This is a huge break. You're in a break with a band. You got three or four others who are green, just like you. You usually got a manager who, maybe has a little experience. It's your first record. They probably don't put you with the biggest producer, someone else trying to make a name. And you can kind of all grow together. You are with veterans, Ted Nugent, Jack Blades, Tommy Shaw. I'm sure all their managers are there who are got names and establishments. Your first producer is Ron Nevison. All the crew guys aren't crew guys, probably that, when you're a young band, you're bringing your Clevelanders with you. They're all crew guys, probably from Night Ranger and Ted's World and Tommy's World. You got all this knowledge, all these miles, all the clout. And then there's you, not putting that down, but you did you sometimes feel alone? I mean, I think about that in my position. I'd just be like, kind of like being in New York City for the first time and just looking up, or did, kind of like what you said, did they make it easy for you in that
It
process?
could have gone the way that you were, intimating, of the feeling alone, odd man out, the green kid who hasn't done anything. It could have gone that way, but it didn't, because Tommy, Jack, and Ted took me under wing. And this molding of the Play-Doh that I keep talking about, that was a real thing. All of their years of collective experience became my umbrella. And it's how I grew, because they wanted me to do it. And each of them played a very specific role in how I grew and developed as the drummer in that band,
What?
including their managers. They each had a manager, and when we released that first record, those three managers created a company that managed me. So everyone was kind of involved in the bring the kid under the wing kind of thing.
What do you remember? of that photo shoot?
Yeah. So that is in this funky alley in the outskirts of downtown LA. I couldn't tell you where it was. The man who took both of those photos is a very famous photographer named Ethan Russell. Ethan Russell has worked with everyone from the Beatles to the Stones. And when we did the photo session, the record was already done. If memory serves, we were mixing it at the time. And one night we just went down to this little alley and took those photos. And I remember thinking, how real it felt, because all of this thing of being in the zone at the recording studio, and I've been playing these songs for 10 months now. You know, here we go, let's go through it again one more time. That was my comfort zone. All of a sudden now, I'm in a photo session with three famous guys, with the guy who shot the Beatles for the album cover for a Warner Brothers Records release. And that night, I was nervous.
Was
And
this
that night, I had a couple beers.
the was this the
Oh,
first
wow.
photo shoot you guys had done, like professionally as Damn Yankees?
No. The first one is behind you on the wall.
Ah, all right.
So that photo of us is we were oh, you know what? I'm sorry. That's a different photo. That the photo on the Damn Yankees poster behind you was a proper photo session. The very first photo that we did as a proper band photo was while we were mixing the first Damn Yankees record. Right around the time we probably took the album cover photo, we decided we were going to do a surprise appearance in LA. So we went to a club on Sunset Boulevard. I have photos of this event. And in my scrapbook, I've written down the name of the club where it happened. I wish I could tell you right now. But what I am going to do is I'm going to email it to you, the name of this club. I don't know how you can get that into the podcast after the fact.
I'll figure it out.
Okay. So, unannounced, we did a 3-4 song set at this club on Sunset Boulevard. And we, much like the China Club thing, we just got up and played the gear that was there. And we played 3 or 4 songs. Pile Driver was definitely one of them. Coming of Age was definitely one of them. And in the dressing room of that club, we took our first band photo. And you have absolutely seen it. We used it on a Japanese tour poster. And it's the four of us. I think they're all wearing guitars. I'm wearing a jean jacket, the same jean jacket I'm wearing in that poster behind you. And it's right before we went onto that stage.
Now I'm gonna have to, start digging through the archives to find that.
If you go on my Instagram page, just keep scrolling back. You'll see a Japanese tour poster, and it's got the photo that I'm talking about. I'm wearing the jean jacket. I think Jack is wearing a long sleeve black shirt that's from some rollerblading company or something. Tommy's also wearing a jean jacket. They're definitely holding their guitars. And it's the You can see it's a dingy little dressing room of a club because there's graffiti all on the walls behind us.
I'm going to have to search for it. I'm probably missing it, but I'll post a picture of it when I find it, and we post this
I have to say
episode.
one other thing
Yeah.
before we move forward. When you were talking about the overwhelming possibility of I'm in a situation where famous guys with their famous techs and their famous managers and their famous record producers, and how, well, sure, you know, the tech is going to be from Night Ranger and the tech is going to be from Styx. My drum tech, Moonlight Drive, Cleveland, Ohio.
There you go. So you,
Brought Cleveland with me. There
so was Coming of Age was the first video and single.
Yes. That video was directed by Ethan Russell, the same man who took the album cover photo.
Was that the first MTV music video that you'd filmed? You didn't do any of the videos for Tommy's album.
I did not do any Tommy videos.
So.
That's the first MTV music video I was ever on
So,
or filmed.
what do you remember about that experience?
It's not what you think it's going to be. But it's a funny story. Well, first of all, it was thrilling to do it, of course. But what I remember about the experience was we were in this huge sound stage in LA. And apparently, right before we were there, they had just filmed one of those Child's Play movies, you know, with Chucky. And I happened to see over in one section of the sound stage this big pile of junk and staging, and I couldn't really tell, but I wandered over there and there was a Chucky doll in it, which I took home. So, probably not what you're expecting from the
The question is, do you still have it?
I don't still have it, no. But it was so fun filming that video, and having never filmed one, I didn't know what to anticipate, so you know, I wasn't aware that you end up, you know, playing lip syncing, as it were, you know, a gazillion times because they're doing different camera setups and different lighting setups, far, close, just this guy, these two guys, but you keep playing the song over and over. Well, at first, I was playing the drums along with the song, full tilt, bashing away. You know, we had a little PA so we could hear the track so we could make sure we were in sync. Well, I was physically playing the song 400% stun volume over and over and over and over. And then after a while, I finally realized, you know, I'm not even in this shot. It's a close-up of Jack singing. Why am I killing myself? So by the end of the day, I had kind of figured it out.
Especially with all those takes, man, your arms would be like spaghetti at the
Yeah,
at
but
the
I was a rock and roll machine. I could have gone for days without stopping.
what you know with my timeline, I was the world's so different now than it was back then. I didn't know anything about rock magazines. So, I'm 12 years old in 1989. I find out from a record store Night Ranger broke up. I've liked Night Ranger since I was six. That's half my life. I just thought, what am I going to do now? And I just remember my aunt had said they had seen a video on MTV and Jack Blades was in a new band with Tommy Shaw and Ted Nugent. Well, I knew Tommy Shaw I knew the name because my aunt had bought Ambition at a record store and I was with her. And I just remember the album cover and she's like, he was in a band, Styx. Well, I'm thinking like Tree Styx. I'm like, that's a shitty name for a band. And that's all I knew of Tommy Shaw. And I just remember my aunt, other aunt having Ted Nugent records and me being a little kid thinking his name was Nugget. I'm like, that's, so I knew of the names, but nothing else really. And, but there was hope for this 13-year-old, 12-year-old kid. I maybe can have a new favorite band. And I remember I stayed the night with my buddy and I woke up early that morning and we were out in his living room and I turned on MTV, which at that point I didn't watch a lot of MTV. I was already past, all these bands by 12 or 13. I was more like Aerosmith, Motley Crue, and I didn't get into Warrants and LA Guns. I mean, I do now, but back then I was like too good for that. And I just remember MTV on, being on for like 2 hours. And then all of a sudden that damn Yankees video comes on and I'm like, oh. And just, glued to the screen and who's that guy? Who's that guy? And going to the record store, a little record store in town. Yeah, the album comes out in 2 weeks, and saving my paper route money and going and getting the cassette and, like I said, just unfolding it and studying everything and seeing your Cleveland Indians hat and, all those photos and, the little photos in there. And I even think it's on this back picture. There's spray paint, like writing on the wall. Like I would see if like, is there any hidden messages, stuff like that. So I mean, that's how, I came into the the damn Yankees world. Do you remember the first time hearing Coming of Age on the radio?
Vividly.
Where were you?
I was sitting in a U-Haul rental truck, and I had just moved down to the Washington, D.C. area. There was a period of time when I left New York, and it was after, obviously, right after the record came out. And I went to the Washington, D.C. area and lived there for about a year or so. And then from there, I moved to LA. But I was sitting in a U-Haul truck with the furniture that I'd just driven down from New York. And I had on the rock radio station. And there came Coming of Age. And it was surreal. I felt like I was looking in on somebody else's life for a minute. It was so cool.
Do you remember the first time walking into a music store and being able to go and grab your cassette or a CD?
Absolutely.
Where was that?
You'd move them up front.
And
D is a little bit further, but you'd click.
what's
I
even.
remember all of this. I remember going to record stores and getting the trade magazines to look at the Hot 100, the Billboard. It was in Billboard, of course, and see, to watch how it was climbing. And Coming of Age, that made it into the top 10 of rock radio when that single came out. I don't
That
remember off the top of my head how high it went, but definitely top 10.
it went high enough.
Nice. Hold on.
But that was where I first got introduced to rock magazines. I was at a little grocery store, probably with my grandma or something, and I saw a rock magazine, and I'm like, "Oh, rock magazine!" I opened it up, and there was a spread on Damn Yankees, and I was
Nice.
like, "I had to get it." And I mean, I probably read that interview 100 times, but what I remember is it had pictures of you guys at the China Club.
Oh, really? They published that? I didn't know
Well, because to me it was like, it looked like a stage that could have been anywhere. It
Yeah,
was
just
just,
a little quarter stage about 18 inches high off the
yeah.
ground.
And I just remember thinking, again, I'm 12 years old, just like, I would do anything to have, been there, right? But yeah, I mean, I just remember it had, pictures of, I know Jack and Ted, but it said China Club, like in neon lights or
Yeah,
something.
yep.
Yep. That's how I knew it was the China Club. But yeah, I got that magazine and I read it religiously. And like I said, well, I don't know if I told you, but again, I was 6 years old. I was always into music. My aunt's like, listen to this Night Ranger record. And I was playing Atari or something. I'm like, leave me alone. Next day, I went back, put that record on, and I was like, what is this? This isn't what's on, this isn't Kaja Goo Goo, what's on MTV. Became a fan. My grandma took me to go see Night Ranger when I was 8 years old in 1985. So, damn Yankees do their first tour. I somehow knew that they were going to be in Columbus, begged my mom or whatever to get me tickets, and she won it. The day of the show or the day before, they surprised me with a ticket, and my two aunts that I told you had Ted Nugent records and stuff, they were going to take me. And of course, we're picking up, I mean, they were still in their early 20s. They were partying a little bit, and we were a little bit late. I just remember walking in, and I could hear you guys already playing. It's like, fuck. But I bought the t-shirt. I got a t-shirt, and I got to see you guys up there, playing. And what I remember is you guys didn't play high enough. I think it was before the single was released. And you guys were opening for Bad Company.
That's right.
So I just remember that was just something. I just remember like what songs you played off the record. And then you each played, a Styx song and a Ted song and Night Ranger song. So you was the first dates with Bad Company?
Yes. Although the first performance that we ever did was Japan.
So you guys went to Japan first.
Yeah, the poster I was talking about, that was our very first Japan tour, and Damn Yankees actually debuted live in Japan, the full concert. I know we've been talking about getting up and doing two and three songs at a club, but the first actual Damn Yankee concerts, plural, were June 1990 in Japan.
Was that a good thing for you? I mean, for you to,
Amazing.
I mean, well, I guess what I'm saying is it a good way to break in this new band, like maybe over in Japan and not in the States? I mean, was that any of the thinking or?
Well, Tommy, Ted, certainly Jack had huge followings in Japan. It was a great way to do a couple concerts and fine-tune the live show before debuting in the States.
That had to be s surreal, though, finally getting to be on that big stage.
Oh yeah, it was awesome. And by the way, it wasn't before long that High Enough came into the show.
Oh yeah, because I think it was that same later that month.
Well, so High Enough was the third single, wasn't it?
Second.
Coming of Age, Come Again was third.
Third.
Right, okay.
So I saw you guys like August 2nd, 1990, and if I remember correctly, I mean, obviously I could be wrong, but I'm usually not. Middle of August, it was released as the second single,
That sounds about
and
right. I can give you even more specific dates, and that is when the video for High Enough was done, which was filmed in New Orleans, great video. That video became number one on MTV. And 1990, the week between Christmas and New Year's, they just froze the playlist at MTV. And at that point, our video was number one. So rather than the way they turn over and they update the playlist, they froze us right during the holiday stretch. So that video played endlessly, and that's what made that first album go double platinum.
Yeah.
You also got a which was it's a really cool achievement. We received a gold single award for High Enough. So we sold 500,000 little 45s of High Enough. And it's in the other room on the wall, but it's a gold single of High Enough. Pretty cool. Pretty cool award.
And you have High Enough. You guys did a video for Come
Again,
Again.
and Coming of Age. Yep.
We just had guitar tech Mark Newman on the podcast. Long history with Night Ranger and Damn Yankees. And he told the story of the New York State Fair in Syracuse. Now, leading up to this, he was amazed. Again, I'm 13 years old. Anything I can find of, Damn Yankees, whatever. We used to get like a life in our the Columbus Dispatch. There was like a lifestyles, section. And if you opened up to the second page, it had like the Hollywood gossip and stuff. And in there, it had Styx Damn Yankees Brawl. And it talked about this incident at the New York State Fair. Obviously, what, I'll give a little bit of pretext and you can tell the story. Styx is playing, one night, the very next night, Damn Yankees is playing. Damn Yankees rolls into town. Obviously, there's some bad blood between Styx, Tommy Shaw. You guys rule in the town. What happens?
We went to see them play. We were sitting up in the bleachers in the nosebleeds in the cheap seats. And I remember some people having the realization of Tommy Shaw? What is Tommy Shaw doing at a Styx gig sitting in the bleachers in bad seats? But it was Tommy, Jack, myself, and a handful of the crew guys, and obviously Mark Newman was there. And we went backstage to say hello after they were done. And because there was some history, we weren't allowed backstage. We were turned away. And that was kind of an unusual circumstance and a little surprising. And then, just by chance, and it wasn't a brawl, but it was definitely unusual that we were turned away to go say hello. Just by chance, when we get back to our hotel, it's the same hotel that Styx is staying in. And although I wasn't there, because by this time I was already in my room, I do know that Tommy connected with the guys in the band, and they sat down and they smoothed everything out, and they were back to being good friends again.
Now, I know you said you guys couldn't get backstage, but was anyone able to get backstage somehow? Did Jack by chance make it back here?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Remember, we all walked down to the backstage gate and we were turned away, and then we went back to the hotel.
Yeah, because I from the stories I've heard, Jack was able to sneak by and gave him an earful, but
I can see Jack doing that.
yeah,
I'd have to ask him. I
you
don't remember.
know what? Talking to Mark brought it all back. I've never brought it up to Jack. I did have Glenn Burtnick, who
Who was in
replaced
the band at the time?
Tommy. I had him because I'm a big Glenn Burtnick fan. I had him on the podcast years ago, and I'm not sure if I even brought it up. I can't remember. I mean, I did talk to him about the dynamics of,
Sure.
damn Yankees being out there and him replacing Tommy and stuff. But so you
I
guys,
wonder if Glenn was even aware that this was going on.
I
Because
don't
when
know.
we did that, we didn't see anybody from the band.
Yeah.
It was just the security there, and they said, yes, they know you guys are here. They, we've been told that
Yeah.
you're not to be brought backstage. Okay.
So you guys do monster touring all of 90, 91. High Enough obviously takes you guys to another level. Did you guys always know that there was going to be a second record?
Yes.
All right, there you go. Part two. Hopefully you enjoyed it. I know you did. So make sure you tune in here in a couple weeks. We'll have the final installment, part three, for you. Go out there, click subscribe to the YouTube channel, and go to Facebook, type in Fans in Motion, Night Ranger, click join, all that good stuff. We will see you soon. Thanks for listening.